Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 30. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. What evidence is there of Amanita muscaria mushroom and other drug use in Afghanistan? Did the Sufis employ psychoactive substances? What are the Moroccan goatmen? Is there a possible link between intoxicating sacramental use of milk and Muhammad's landmark visionary experience through the seven heavens? How does the new evidence of prehistoric mushroom use in Europe affect current academic arguments against such use? Is there a link to the word marijuana and the Chinese language? My guest is British independent scholar Alan Piper, an expert on psychoactive substances and ancient religions. In this two-part series, we'll be discussing Zoroastrianism, Sufism, Amanita muscaria, the phlegeric mushroom, intoxicating milk and meat, new evidence of prehistoric mushroom use in Europe, the origins of the word marijuana, and much more. Alan Piper was born in 1953 and, like many others of his generation, encountered psychedelic culture in his teenage years. His father undertook psycholytic therapy in the 1950s, and so Alan grew up with the likes of Aldous Huxley and Henry Michau on the family bookshelves, which were a point of reference for him in his own encounters with the psychedelic experience. And like many others of his generation, he moved away from the psychedelics and into an exploration of Eastern religions and Hermetic philosophies, looking for a context for his own entheogenic experiences. Laid off from a macrobiotic food company in the 1980s, Alan took the opportunity to take a degree course in the history of ideas, partly as an opportunity to put the new religious movements which emerged from the 1960s into a cultural context. As part of his study of religious, philosophical, and scientific ideas, his undergraduate studies involved the study of historical method, the discipline of doing history. The second wave of psychedelia, rave culture, and entheogenic neo-shamanism hit around the time of his graduation. The writings of Terence McKenna renewed Alan's interest in entheogens and their role in human cultures. A couple of his early papers on entheogenic topics brought Alan in touch with members of the community of entheogenic scholarship, and he has been lucky to have had support and encouragement from other members of the community and share his explorations with them. Alan has attempted to apply the methodological disciplines learned as an undergraduate to his study of the role of plant drugs in religious history of mankind. However, he recognizes that there are many ways to make sense of the history, some more objective and some more subjective. All attempts to do history involve both reason and the imagination, and our history is the product of an interplay between the dream and necessities of everyday reality. Alan has authored and co-authored the following papers: Esoteric Cosmologies, The Mysterious Origins of the Word Marijuana, The Tree of Life, and The Milk of the Goat Hedron, Barak, depicted as Amanita muscaria in a 5th century Timurid illustrated manuscript. Upcoming shows: Alan Piper Part 2, the completion of this interview, and following that will be Neil Goldsmith, Psychedelics and Psycho-Spiritual Development, and then we will also be having G. Edward Griffin, the creature from Jekyll Island, and he will be discussing the Federal Reserve, And also coming up will be Professor Benny Shannon, author of Antipodes or Antipodes of the Mind, which is one of the best books written on ayahuasca and its experience, and is probably the best piece ever written as far as literature on describing with words the psychedelic experience from ayahuasca. Again, the Spanish subtitle version of the Pharmacratic Inquisition has been released on the pharmacratic-inquisition.com website, so please be sure to check that out, and make sure you send it to anybody you know that speaks Spanish that couldn't check that out before. And also coming up in the next few weeks will be the release of the Russian voiceover version, and also the German edition, which both of those, the translations are done. They're just in final production to get those ready. It's half the work is done, basically. Have to get everything into the subtitles and ready for that. And the DVD is available for free viewing on the pharmacraticinquisition.com website. And all languages are Dutch, Portuguese, Spanish, and English versions. If you are listening to the show and can help with French or Arabic editions, that would be hugely appreciated, so please contact me for that. Also, if anyone can help with transcriptions for the shows, we still need your help. We've gotten a few of them done, but there's more, so if you're interested in helping, please contact me at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And this show is run on donations, and if you would like to support this programming, please go to www.gnosticmedia.com and click on the donations button at the top left of the page, or you can also click on donations on the Podomatic, GnosticMedia.podomatic.com website. And this show is not corporate media. This is independent media in the truest sense of the words, and by supporting this show with your donations, you help continue, or you help keep this show on the air, on the internet, whatever you want to call it. And thanks to everyone who has been donating, and also thanks to everyone who has purchased a book or DVD from the website. Your donations and orders are greatly appreciated. And let's see, you can, on the Gnostic Media website, I do still have copies of Astrotheology and Shamanism that I co-authored with Andrew Rutaji in both black and white and color editions. And color edition will come with a free DVD. I've got 50 of those left, by the way, so when the numbered and signed are gone, they're gone, so get one while they're still available. And speaking of Andrew, his latest video, Manifesting the Mind, is now available through Bouncing Bear Films. If you'd like to check that out, you can order a copy by clicking on the Bouncing Bear banner on the Gnostic Media website, and it will provide you where you can buy the film directly right there on the site there. If you purchase the DVD by clicking on the banner on the Gnostic Media website, part of your purchase without any additional cost to you will go to support Gnostic Media. Also available on the Gnostic Media website, my latest book, The Holy Mushroom, and as I've said before, I'm autographing those for anyone interested. You know, and hopefully that will become a collector's item, especially with the hopefully soon to be republication of The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross that's still delayed, and getting Judy on the show for that is still delayed at this time because of that, so I'm not going to make any promises at this point. Speaking of books, I discovered yesterday that some booksellers are already selling the first edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism for over $300. And in fact, the cheapest one I saw was on Amazon for $58. So those of you who decided to pick up a copy of that before it went out of print, you're in luck. The value has gone up dramatically on that. So that's always good to know. So hopefully these other books will go up in value like that as well. So maybe you can get your return several times over. Lastly, on the Gnostic Media website, and I mentioned this before, are the She Who Remembers audio archives. And if you haven't checked those out, you definitely should. And we really appreciate your support. And please go to www.gnosticmedia.com and you can check out the website, the forums, everything there. You can also check out, look me up on Facebook or on MySpace and MySpace/Yon-Irvine or something like that, but it's up there as well. And the views expressed by the authors and guests of this program are their own and are not necessarily those held by the host or Gnostic Media. And if you'd like to contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And I'm going to start today's show by playing Doom Mast Kalindar, provided by Alan, which is a song, I believe, Moroccan, possibly. I forget exactly on that. But we'll be discussing the meaning of this tune in part two. Enjoy the show.
Da 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 da.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 30. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Jan. It's a beautiful evening here, actually. I can hear kids playing outside. The sun is shining, and it's a lovely day.
Whereabouts do you live?
I live in East London, so not far from Whitechapel, that some people might have heard of from like Jack the Ripper legends and that kind of thing. But it's a working class kind of district, but it's a pleasant area.
Well, do you want to talk a little bit about your educational background and who you are and what drives you?
Well, I'll tell you something about my educational background. I was lucky enough to go to a private school on a scholarship, and which meant that I studied Latin and so on. And that was in the countryside. That was actually close to Glastonbury, which is a focus of a lot of Grail legends and that kind of thing. And it's an area I've gone back to quite a number of times. And then at high school, I went through and studied French and Latin and English up to high school level, or I guess you'd call high school level, up to about the age of 18. And certainly all of that's been useful to my studies, being able to read some French and Latin and so on. And then I really abandoned my studies. It was just back in the early 70s and so on. I was a bit of a hippie, I guess, and had a bit of a sort of gypsy lifestyle. And I worked for a whole food company for a number of years. And when I was made redundant, that's to say laid off, I went back to college and took a degree. And that degree was in the history of ideas. So I have a BA in history of ideas. And that means to say that involved the study of scientific ideas, political ideas, philosophical ideas, and religious ideas. And in addition, as part of that, I studied historical method. You know, that's the doing of history. And then after I'd taken that degree, not so long after, I guess, I became aware of the works of people like Terence McKenna. And that was really when I started my entheogenic studies. For me, I guess it was natural to apply some of the disciplines, the academic kind of disciplines that I've learned as an undergraduate to my entheogenic studies. I mean, not to make too much of this. I mean, it's 25 years ago or so now. But, you know, an awareness that they're like primary and secondary sources, you know, that you've got to have a critical view of both of those. And if you're studying an area, then you have to have a wide knowledge. You have to be aware of the full spectrum of current academic thought on your subject, so you can place your own position, your own studies within that. And also, I guess, to consider one's own motives, you know, what is driving you yourself. If you're simply setting out you're determined to prove something, so to speak. I mean, your guest, Dovkin de Rios, talked a little bit about methodology and so on, inductive and deductive and such like. So when you're studying, you have to be aware of those kind of disciplines and where you're coming from yourself.
Right. Let me ask you this. Did your studies cover the New Testament?
Well, they didn't particularly, but there certainly are a few things I'd like to say about New Testament studies. The New Testament, I mean, if you look at the New Testament itself, I'm sure that you're aware of a lot of this, and I'm not sure how much your listeners will be, but there's a great gap, a great hiatus between the presumed area of Christ's ministry and the emergence of the Christian church itself. And
right.
What happened between is really a mystery. I mean, the actual origins, who, for example, who wrote the Gospels isn't really known. And, when the Christian church as such first emerged, as well, isn't clear, you know, unless you accept, you know, the apostolic succession of the Catholic Church or whatever, then you have to accept that, you know, that these things are rather mysterious and they aren't certain. So, you know, the New Testament is not history. The New Testament are stories which have been recorded. And really, I think they're probably best viewed as statements of faith of an emerging religion. Is that something that rings true with you yourself, Jan?
Yeah, you know, and I see a lot of the earlier cultures. You've got the Gnostics and the Zadokites and the Essenes and several of these different groups that appear to have been sort of amalgamated into what is today Christianity. And but I certainly agree that there appears to be about a 2 or 3 century gap there in what we know from the beginning of the first or end of the last century BCE into the 3rd or 4th century CE. There seems to definitely be a big a gap in exactly what we know, and even the Christian iconography, as John Rush points out in his work, is there's almost no truly Christian iconography or artwork from that period either. So it's you know, what you're looking at are stories of these different characters that were sort of later, it appears that they were later applied to this Jesus Christ character. So,
there's a couple of things I'd like to say about that. I mean, one is that my impression is that liberal scholarship now at least accepts that the early Christian church was extremely diverse. And these kind of groups that are now classed, of course, they didn't call themselves Gnostic, which are seen as Gnostic as being unorthodox from the church which eventually emerged, the Roman church. And that I think that the liberal scholarship now accepts that early Christianity was tremendously diverse, and these groups that are seen as being, in inverted commas, or classified as heretical, are simply part of the diversity of the early Christian church, which, you know, within the Roman Empire, it became an orthodoxy, was shaped into an orthodoxy. And I'm sure that you're familiar with probably more of the details than I am. But it's this gap in the knowledge and so on, and the uncertainty about the early years of the Christian church and concerning the Gospels themselves that allows this tremendous diversity of interpretation. You know, Jesus was a revolutionary, Jesus was a magician, you know, Jesus was gay or whatever it may be. So there's this great gap, and it allows, or this uncertainty in terms of the data, that allows a huge variety of interpretation.
How did you begin to study shamanism and psychedelic drugs?
Well, like I'm sure a few of your other interviewees, when I was in my late teens and my early 20s, that was the sort of, you know, the hippie era and the summer of love and all that kind of thing. And so I smoked a bit of weed and took some acid and all that kind of thing. And then I think, like a lot of other people who had those experiences, those entheogenic or psychedelic experiences, it led into a curiosity about Eastern religions or other religions, religions and figures that you could identify with. And so I sort of moved away from the use of psychedelics and so on, and into a bit of experimentation or investigation into Eastern religions and that kind of thing. And then following that a little bit into esotericism of one sort or another. And that really carried me right through to, and was part of the background to taking my degree in history of ideas. It was a desire to investigate those things a little bit more fully.
Well, your own background certainly sounds similar to mine, so it's pretty much the exact same
I think that's path. The same probably for quite a few what you might call psychedelic elders, as it were, you know.
Right.
And But there's a few things I'd like to say about that, and it does tie in certain ways with psychedelics or entheogens and in the history of ideas. You know, when we'd had these experiences, we started looking for people that we could identify with, and so we discovered people like Baudelaire, you know, the bohemians of the late 19th and early 20th century, Aleister Crowley, people who'd experimented with drugs in a magical setting and all that kind of thing. And it became what I call, in the sense of, a sort of, we didn't call ourselves hippies, we called ourselves heads or freaks. That was our kind of terminology. And it became a kind of...
Heads is still the standard terminology in the U.S. today.
Mm-hmm. And it became a kind of spot the heads of history. You know, was it William Blake? You know, was it, you know, and so on. And you had a feeling when you looked at the writings or the art of certain people, well, you know, this guy must have taken something, you know, must have had a similar experience. And of course, now we know it wasn't really, you know, a psychedelic experience, that there are other ways in which.
Oh, you're cutting out there. Are you there?
So Jan, I was saying that out of the sort of psychedelic experience and sort of entheogenic experiences which one experienced through psychedelics, we found ourselves looking for people from history, artists and writers and so on, with whom we could identify. We were looking for a context in which to place our own psychedelic experiences. So there was a kind of spot the heads from history approach, you know. So one might be saying William Blake or Ezekiel or whoever, you know, the kind of experiences that they were describing. You felt, well, these people had to have had a psychedelic experience or had to have taken something. Of course, now we know that they didn't necessarily have taken an entheogen as such, because there are other ways in which those sorts of experiences can emerge. But we were looking for a context in which to place our experiences.
In your opinion, why do you think that amanitas are depicted so often in artwork and discussed so much in religious research, when their effects seem so varying and their ergonomics, per se, of being effective aren't necessarily always optimal?
Well, I've got to say, Jan, that my own experience with amanitas has been a little disappointing in a sense. You know, I've taken them on a number of occasions, and not in small doses. Certainly, I found they've engendered an experience that could be called entheogenic, but nothing compared to, say, psilocybin mushrooms, or certainly not LSD. And I would say this: if our amanita was powerfully and pleasantly psychedelic, then I think that this would have been discovered some time ago by, you know, those of us who experiment with them, with mushrooms and so on. How it is psychoactive, there's no question about that, but I suspect that Carl Ruck and others are right in suggesting that even if it was supplanted by the use of other psychoactives in terms of popular use, that it's remained an important kind of icon, if you like, of the soma principle in cultural memory. And I mean, we've got no idea really about what the true extent of the historical use of amanita is. I mean, the difficulty with mushrooms is that they lead, unless you have, of course, you know, an artifactual evidence, they leave, you know, almost no evidence of their use. However, we do have these petroglyphs, the petroglyphs in Kamchatka at the Pektimel site, the Pektimel River site. And I think you've seen some of the illustrations of those in papers that I've sent you.
Sure.
And those date to, well, estimated as about 3000 BC, I think. And I mean, the important thing about the Kamchatka site, the Pektimel site, is that the Chukchi people who live there, are still making use of the amanita mushroom. And despite the fact that that some observers are skeptical that these petroglyphs necessarily represent mushroom spirits or people under the influence of mushrooms, because in these petroglyphs you have human figures with mushroom heads, or with what are clearly, to me anyway, mushrooms are above their heads. But it's, my point there, I think I was about to say that it's very difficult to place any other interpretation upon them, you know, unless you're extremely skeptical. But coming back to your point, yes, I think their use is probably extremely ancient, and but supplanted by other psychoactives over time, and possibly in relatively recent history, you know, in the Siberian kind of context, by the use of alcohol.
What do you think about the mixture of various substances, like say, you know, the mixture of psilocybin and amanita together as sort of an alchemical preparation based on, you know, coloring and things like that?
Well, I'd have to say about that, Jan, it's not something that I'm familiar with. It's a speculation to me, unless there's pretty concrete evidence that that's the case.
What societies do we know that are still using Amanita muscaria today?
Well, the use of Amanita today is largely confined to the extreme west and east of Siberia. That's to say the Khanty people in the west and the Chukchi people in the east. And I think to a degree this can actually be seen as evidence of the fact that their use was probably much more widespread right across Eurasia. So I think there's a view that that cultural artifacts at the extreme fringes, so to speak, are the most antique evidence, as it were. So yes, so the extreme west and the extreme east of Siberia.
So how, in your opinion, do the mushrooms tie in with Zoroastrianism?
Well, I'm not aware of any particular evidence for the use of mushrooms in Zoroastrianism. There is an important Zoroastrian scholar whose name I think is James Hinnells. And there's, in fact, I'd say a couple of things about Zoroastrian scholarship. One is there's very, very few scholars of Zoroastrianism. The two I think most important are Mary Boyce and a chap called R.C. Zainer. And then there's this John Hinnells, who's a bit more contemporary. But the important thing about Zoroastrianism really is that here, as well as Hinduism or the ancient Vedic scriptures and contemporary Hinduism, here in Zoroastrianism we've got a religion with a psychoactive plant as its sacrament. I mean, the remarkable thing about the scholarship, if you look at books about Zoroastrianism by individuals like Mary Boyce, is that although the Homer, as it is, which is the equivalent of the Soma in the Vedic scriptures, although the Homer in Zoroastrianism is absolutely central to the worship in Zoroastrianism, it is a sacrament which is, you know, it's repeated in a daily religious observances. It's only treated very, very marginally in academic texts about Zoroastrianism. But what we have, I mean, we talk about Zoroastrianism, of course. For anyone who's not familiar, it's the religion of Iran, or the original religion of Iran or Persia, as some people might know it from the past. And in fact, Zoroastrianism refers specifically to a particular stage of the development of the ancient Iranian religion, which is under the prophet Zoroaster. But the religion itself goes much, much further back, and goes back into extreme antiquity, and is sometimes referred to as Mazdaism, which refers to the god of Zoroastrianism, Ahura Mazda. And Zoroaster himself is seen as a reformer, but his date is extremely uncertain. It could be anything from sort of, you know, a few hundred years BC to a few thousand years BC, and academics are divided on it. But the important thing is the centrality of this plant sacrament, and that that Zoroastrianism exists today, and it existed contemporaneously with the emergence of Christianity, side by side with Christianity in terms of the Roman Empire and the Persian Empire in the early years AD and so on. Concerning the Homer itself and the issue of mushrooms, well, the Homer now, as you know yourself, Jan, is ephedra, which has some notoriety in the States as the ingredient in slimming pills. I'm not sure whether now it's been outlawed there in the States. It's not illegal in the UK, but ephedra is a sort of naturally occurring amphetamine. Right. However, in the Zoroastrian scriptures, it's a little bit similar to the Homer issue, that that in debating what the, sorry, the Soma issue, in debating what the Soma may have been, one of the questions is, by reference to the Vedas, is the kind of experiences which engenders. And in key Zoroastrian scriptures, it's plain that the plant could not at that time have been ephedra, from my current understanding of the effects of ephedra, because it was clearly used to see into the spirit world, to see into a spiritual reality, and that's absolutely clear from key scriptures in Zoroastrianism. So, for example,
I was just going to add. Yes, so the evidence doesn't appear to suggest it was something that gives you the jitters like coffee or cocaine or something.
Well, that's absolutely not. You know, it's described as the sort of divine substance for seeing into the spiritual reality, you know, and expressions of that kind. And in terms of Zoroaster himself, you know, he had a ministry like Christ, if you like, and was struggling. There was a certain king, King Vishdasp. And in order to convince him of the importance and reality of his mission, God brought the Homer to King Vishdash by tradition, and the experience that he had with the Homer convinced him of Zoroaster's the reality and importance of Zoroaster's mission. But no, there's no way that it's just purely an effigy. I think, I mean, are you aware of the investigations of Victor Sarianidi, the Russian archaeologist?
I'm not.
Oh, well, he's quite important. I mean, there's arguments over his work. But in Central Asia, you know, he believed himself to have found temples used for preparing a mixed brew. And he had some of the receptacles and so on there analyzed. And the data showed the presence of opium, of cannabis, and ephedra,
I was aware of the discoveries, but I didn't recall his name. So go ahead.
Oh, yes. So I mean that's quite important in terms of suggesting that that mixed brews were used, and I mean there's a long history of the use of mixed brews of one sort or another. There are these substances known variously as bars, barsh, and so on within the Middle East. So you have these electuaries, these compounds which mix cannabis and opium, henbane, datura, and so on. And their use is widely attested, you know, right across North Africa, the Middle East, and into Asia. So, you know, there's no mystery here. There's no question, should we say, that through history there's been a wide use of mixed psychoactive brews of one sort or preparations of one sort or another. They're well attested, and so on the one hand, we shouldn't be surprised to find these temple sites, for example, that Sarianidi has found. And it places a question over whether we should be looking for a single plant, you know, when we're talking about Soma or Homer. And almost certainly, pragmatically, one can understand that man has used whatever was available, you know, whatever the market brought to him, whatever was growing nearby. And
right.
And that's necessarily going to have been the case.
Well, you know, and we, myself and Andrew Rutaji, argued in the first book that I wrote, Astrotheology and Shamanism, that it was a mixture, and, you know, that it, we didn't think that it was one plant, that it was many. And certainly when you think of the mixed wines and you think of David Hillman's book, The Chemical Muse, and the mixtures there, and I had suggested the Amanita and psilocybe mixture earlier, but I really think that these mixtures was a key factor in these ancient medicines, and often, if not more often than not, these mixtures. And you know, so I would fully agree with the interpretation that it seems to me it's just overly self-limiting to focus on one plant. And
indeed,
you know, Christian Ratch has found 108 plants dedicated to Shiva alone.
Well, that speaks to for itself, really, Jan. And I think that to come back to the Middle East and to Central Asia and to Iran, I know you probably wanted me to speak a little bit about Sufism, and there is this this Burak illustrated manuscript which I wrote a paper on. In terms of Islam, what I think we find is that that very antique practices, which are pre-Islamic, have been assimilated into Islam, and that Iran was central in this. And I mean, the Iran was conquered, so to speak, by Islam very, very early in the development of Islam, in the sort of mid 7th century, really not long after Islam itself emerged. And so at that time, the indigenous religious practices would have been, you know, Zoroastrianism of one sort or another. It's all right to say Zoroastrianism, but of course we're talking about religious traditions which are thousands of years old, will have taken many different forms locally and regionally and so on. but following the Iran becoming Islamicized, these antique practices were assimilated into the fringes, if you like, of Islam, and into these kind of esoteric aspects. And I think that you find where within religions that become formalized and heavily structured and politicized, that the more unorthodox elements, the mystical kind of elements, are quite happy to assimilate all kinds of practices which allow them to make contact with the divine and so on. So the use of psychoactive preparations, which is well attested within certain aspects of unorthodox, shall we say, Islam, was almost certainly assimilated in the first place, particularly from Iranian practices.
Let's switch gears for a moment and let's talk about Islam. And doing psychedelic drugs is really considered anathema to Orthodox Islam, but what evidence is there to suggest that Muhammad may have used possibly mushrooms or other drugs in his travels through the seven gates with Burak?
Well, myself, Jan, I wouldn't want to suggest that Muhammad himself necessarily made use of any drug. The paper that I published on Burak, which shows Muhammad ascending through the seven heavens on this creature, which is called Burak, which is like a sort of winged steed, a winged horse or a winged donkey. This steed is depicted in this Timurid manuscript from Herat, which is central Afghanistan. It's depicted with apparently the characteristics of Armanus and Muscaria. But my view on that is that that Muhammad's ecstatic gets sent through the seven heavens to receive the instructions for the faithful, that as that tradition has been brought into different cultures, they've interpreted it in a way in which made sense to them. So my view is that this particular manuscript where you see Barak with the physical characteristics, he's red with these white spots of the Almanis Muscaria, this is an interpretation, a local cultural interpretation, which understood ecstatic ascent to be achieved through the use of, in this case, the Almanisa mushroom. And certainly there are there's evidence for the use of Almanisa muscaria in Afghanistan, in the region in which this particular artifact, this particular manuscript comes from.
Do you want to talk about more about Afghanistan? And I just had Wolfgang Bauer on the show last week, who also talked a little bit about Afghanistan. But I think that would be great if you could provide a little of your information. It would be a wonderful mixture of minds.
Well, there's a number of things coming out of Afghanistan or out of the Hindu Kush and that kind of region. I mean, there was the use of a manuscript that was recorded there by Hartmut Gierken, who's actually a sort of musician and artist, but in probably the 60s or early 70s recorded the use by these elders. These chaps in the Hindu Kush, in a valley in the Hindu Kush, were mostly, I think, in the 60s or so. That indicates it was a fairly antique practice, but he established there the use of Almanisa. I mean, I doubt if this is an isolated incident, you know, an isolated example. I mean, one thing that I'd say there, which I think is quite important, is that Hartmut Gierken discovered this use of Almanisa, and the investigation, I mean, it's been inadequate investigation into the folk use and the traditional use of Almanis muscaria, and one suspects that the cases which we are aware of, for example, there was a paper published on awareness of its intoxicating effects in Catalonia, in Spain, that once people go looking, then there will be more to be found. But the Hindu Kush really leads me into some of the researches that I did on the psychoactive properties of milk and meat. And I sent you a copy of my unpublished paper. I think it's available through the internet, called the Milk of the Goat and the Hydron. And that research emerged out of this Norse tradition, in the Norse Eddas, where the heroes who went to Valhalla, those who died in battle, there was a tradition that said that there was this goat called Hydron, which nibbled on the leaves of the tree of life. And that from her teats came this mead, which they drank, and that set me wondering whether this was just a folk story, and it was just a kind of metaphor or symbolic in some way, it led me into investigating whether there could be such a thing as psychoactive meat or milk. And the answer is yes. And that it's attested in veterinary science. And that is to say that that when cows feed on certain plants, then that milk can become toxic. So clearly substances pass, as one might imagine, from plants into the milk of mammals. And and I came across...
I was just going to say, to add to that, you know, it's when mothers are breastfeeding, they're told not to eat spicy foods like onions and broccoli and things like that, because these cause colic and other problems directly in the baby. So certainly something's getting through the milk there.
Well, there's, and I mean, as I said, it's attested in veterinary science, and then there's were anecdotal reports which I discovered about milk being intoxicating milk in the Middle East from plants. from goats have been feeding on absinthe type plants containing bitter substances, but there was records saying that the milk of these animals was intoxicating, that it made people dizzy was what it said, but let's we can just say intoxicating. But there was another reference that had caught my attention, that was in one of Wasson's books, saying that reindeer who had been feeding on a manitou mushrooms, that their flesh was intoxicating, at least if it was eaten really quite fresh from the animal being killed. And that leads in a whole set of directions, really. It leads to the suggestion that that man may have even discovered the intoxicating properties of some plants by eating animals which had been feeding on those plants, because they were easily caught because the animal was intoxicated itself. I mean, Giorgio Samarini's book, Animals and Psychedelics, is absolutely vital in this respect, and anyone who finds the subject interesting must have a look at that book. And Giorgio Samarini goes into a whole set of important and fascinating areas. I mean, one of which is the fact that man almost certainly learned of the medicinal and psychoactive properties of plants by observing animal behaviour. And of course, also central to that is the fact that animals themselves have a predilection for eating psychoactive plants. And they return to them and eat them by choice, and obviously enjoy, shall we say, the psychoactive properties of those plants. But there's a number of interesting traditions that attribute the discovery of the psychoactive properties of plants to the behaviour of animals. So coffee in Ethiopian or Yemeni traditions was discovered by observing the friskiness of goats who had been feeding on the coffee plant, and in Greek mythology the discovery of wine was attributed to the frisky behaviour of goats who'd been feeding on the vine, which of course doesn't quite make sense. But it's the same tradition, and we have to ask ourselves, well, what in fact had those goats been eating? And then that leads into goats as a whole, and returns us potentially to the Hindu Kush, where there are these tribal peoples called the Kalash, they live in the valleys of the Hindu Kush, which is, so the Hindu Kush, it sits sort of between Pakistan, Iran, or overlaps with Pakistan, Iran, and Afghanistan, and they have extremely ancient religious beliefs there, which are pre-Islamic. They consciously resist Islam, and they worship Indra and other gods and so on, which are in the Vedas and appear in Hinduism. But they have traditions which are really absolutely fascinating, which is that some of their religious festivals, they have goatsmen, that's to say men put on the skin of goats, or figure puts on the skin of goats, and he's decorated in certain ways. He wears bells, he carries a staff, and he's a figure of, so it's intriguing because he's a figure of kind of mixed fun and fear. That's to say, he sort of threatens and chases women and children in this kind of carnival atmosphere. And most intriguingly, he's recorded as having the cry of ho, 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 which, of course, we all recognize as being the cry of Father Christmas, of Santa Claus. And the Kalash, their shamans, if you like, they use the juniper tree as their intoxicant. They both burn it as a fumigant and inhale the fumes and chew on the leaves of juniper to enter trance states. And as well as having this tradition of goat figures, that's men who dress up in goat skins in a kind of carnival sort of scenario, their shamans eat raw goat flesh. They gnaw on the sacrificed goat head, and so on. But this goat figure is, well, he goes right back through history. He must be extremely ancient because he's present all the way from the Hindu Kush right through to North Africa and in Europe. And he turns up in the Christmas traditions, the older Christmas traditions of Europe.
Especially the traditions, well, Greek traditions, and also with the Pan Hearn figure, which Tony Van Rentergem has talked about, and but yeah, I can see very clearly the correlation that you're making. Very, very fascinating stuff there. Sorry to interrupt you.
Well, that's all right. But the one of the significant things there is that he's associated with intoxication, and. In Morocco, he turns up as this figure called Boujloud, who was popularized by some of the sort of bohemian writers awareness of him was popularized by some of the bohemian writers who settled in Morocco in the 50s and 60s, like William Burroughs and Brian Gissing and so on. And these traditions were brought to the attention of the Rolling Stones, who recorded these Moroccan musicians, the Djoudjouka musicians, the drummers of Djoudjouka, and they play these pipes and play the drums and so on. And this Boujloud figure, which means sort of man of skins, again, it's this goat figure. He appears at the end of Ramadan in the contemporary Moroccan traditions. So it's the end of a fast. Period and so you're having this kind of carnival atmosphere at the end of the fast, and the behaviour is so similar to the figure from the Hindu Kush. That's to say that he chases children and women. He has a stick which he shakes at them and so on. As I said, which points to the extreme antiquity. Yes, and of course. The goat turns up, as you're saying, in Greek traditions. Dionysus is associated with a goat. He dresses in goat skins, or his followers dress in goat skins. And of course, the Kalash, as I said, they eat raw goat flesh, and that takes us towards the Bacchantes and the traditions associated with Dionysus and the Bacchantes and so on, in terms of eating raw flesh, which takes us back to the question that was any of that flesh psychoactive, because those animals had fed on psychoactive plants, either actually or in terms of traditions, ancient traditions, which led to that custom.
Let me ask you this: could seasonally available plants have anything to do with the goat celebrations that were taking place during, you know, maybe the fall or early winter time there?
That's a very interesting question, Jan, which is not one that I've really thought about. But plainly, many of these festivals are seasonal, and for that reason, it certainly makes sense to suggest that that they may be tied to the seasonal availability of a particular entheogenic plants. Can I just add something about the...
Well, let me add this. I was just going to say that, that particular plant may have just been available seasonally that the goats were eating, and, you know, so maybe... Anyway, but yeah, you get the rest of the picture on that. Go ahead.
Yes. Do you know about the puka at all? That's an Irish... figure, a goat or a horse sometimes, or a dog at other times, which sort of waylays unwary travellers and takes them for a wild ride. Are you aware of that at all?
You know, I'm not sure that I am.
Some people have attempted to draw mushroom associations because some puka words are associated with mushrooms. But I think in point of fact that's an error, because certain mushrooms are referred to as the puka's fist, which actually fist in that context means fart. So it means that it's the puka's fart or the devil's fart. So it's not that the mushroom itself is called the puka. But the puka, again, I mean, the thing is, it's a metaphor of some kind for intoxication, but it's associated with an animal. And the interesting thing here is, to me, is the riding an animal as being a metaphor, being taken for a wild ride on an animal, as being a metaphor for intoxication. And puka, the word turns up in Puck. So in Midsummer Night's Dream, you have, you know, Robin Goodfellow, Puck. And he's an incarnation in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream of the puka. He's one version of the puka. And in my paper on Hydron, I include some pictures of Puck from Elizabethan broadsheets. And he bears an extraordinary similarity to, in particular, to the Moroccan goatman, down to very specific details in terms of the costume and so on. So, well, again, this leads us back to the antiquity and of these traditions and how widespread they are, that they reach right across Eurasia and have remained in place, notwithstanding, for example, Europe being essentially Christian. Hello, Jan?
Yeah, I'm here. What do you think, or what do you suggest might be a link between, you know, and I know you mentioned you don't suggest that he was taking anything directly, but what is the connection between Muhammad and the milk and the drugs and these things?
Well, what I do mention is that before Muhammad makes this ascent through the seven heavens, and this mirage, as it's called, that word means ladder, and of course we can associate that with the ladder of Jacob. You know, when Jacob sees the angels ascending and descending from heaven, and the shaman's pole in the tent, and those kinds of traditions, the mirage means the ladder. Before Muhammad ascends, he's offered wine or honey or milk to drink, and he chooses to drink milk. And I did suggest that this to someone with esoteric knowledge, that this could be a reference to Soma, because of course the whole Soma tradition is that this is a preparation that involves milk, and that the substances are mixed with milk, whatever the psychoactive substance is, whatever the Soma plant is. And there are plenty of these psychoactive drinks, if you like, in India and the Middle East. So you've got the Bang Lassi. That's the Bang being, of course, cannabis. The Bang Lassi, which is a milkshake, if you like, made with milk and cannabis, the cannabis plant. So you have this extraordinary green milkshake. And I mean, this leads into another area, which is that these drinks, the Bang Lassi, they're drunk at Hindu festivals, but by your everyday worshippers, and so it's not something outrageous or something strange. You know, of course, those of us who've read about this know that cannabis is Indra's food, it's sacred to Shiva, and so on and so on, and it has a very significant place in Hindu culture. But there we are, the Bang Lassi, and then in the Iranian culture you have these buttermilk preparations with cannabis and spices as well, and henbane or datura or whatever. And I remember reading about one of them, which is called the buttermilk of the divine unity. And so it's possible that that's a reference to either to, of course, psychoactive milk, which I wrote about, or to in some way to Soma type practices.
Is there a relationship, in your opinion, between the serpent and goats, deers, as they appear in regard to the tree of knowledge as a psychoactive sacrament?
Well, there's a few things I could say. I'm not quite sure of the exact context that you're referring to, but
I think in one of your papers you show both the deer and the goat in many artwork depictions as being on either side of the tree of knowledge, in as opposed to the serpent there, which is typically symbolizing the caduceus.
Yes. Well, obviously, that the serpent is a symbol of wisdom, and notwithstanding the idea, of course, that that it was the devil. Let's put that aside
right.
and say that
right.
the serpent is a fundamental symbol of wisdom. I mean, certainly the serpent connects with goats in certain ways, but I'm not sure quite how that would fit. I mean, interestingly enough, in the Iranian traditions, goats are understood to trample on snakes and kill them. So to trample on them and eat them. And so there could be some kind of connection there. Of course, before the nature of poisons and the chemistry of poisons and venoms and so on was understood, it was thought that that the goat derived his poison, his venom, from feeding on plants which contained poisons. So there could be a connection there. I mean, intriguingly, this Iranian tradition, and it may be more widespread than that, but I'm aware of it in Iran, that goats will trample on snakes and eat them, has a further dimension, which is something called the bezoar, which is a stone which is found in the stomach of goats. Are you aware of this at all?
No, I wasn't aware of that.
Yes, the bezoar. Well, goats are killed, or when they're presumably killed for food purposes, there's this stone in their stomach. And it's a kind of a hardened hairball, and it's believed to have a sort of miraculous healing properties and to provide protection against the venom of snakes. And the tradition is, or the understanding is, that the different protective properties of this stone, if you like, you might say a stone that is not a stone, but is actually a something from a goat's stomach, depend upon what herbage the goat has been feeding on. So that certainly points to an awareness amongst people who live in a close relationship with animals, that the kind of herbs that a goat has been feeding on, you know, affect in this case, the properties of this medicine, which is derived from a goat's stomach, a small, hardened, resinous stone. And I have an Iranian research paper which actually shows that the bezoar, this stone, is effective against the effect of snake venoms. And but they weren't able to determine exactly how that worked. So there's a bit of folk wisdom, and there's a connection between goats and snakes and venom. But I'm not sure whether how much that answers your question, Jan.
Well, it's not really in the direction I was heading, but that's certainly fascinating regardless. What I was thinking of is more along the lines of, I believe I had seen some artwork depictions of the goat and or deer on either side of the Tree of Knowledge, just like the serpent entwined around the Tree of Knowledge.
Well, indeed,
shaping.
And those,
what I was getting at is, you know, the serpent wrapped around the Tree of Knowledge, we argue in my first book with Andrew Rutaji that that's actually the caduceus, the symbol of drugs, just like it is today, the symbol of drugs and medicine.
I follow you there. Okay. Follow you, absolutely. Yes.
Right. And then basically what we see then is a replacement of the serpent with either goats and or deer. And to me, it seems that they may almost be used interchangeably there.
Well, I think that, I mean, you know, I'm just following what you're saying here, Jan, and thinking as I'm speaking, but the issue I referred to before, that's to say that it was thought that that snakes derived their poison, their venom, through eating plants which had had poison within the plant, and my references to goats potentially becoming psychoactive in terms of their flesh through eating certain herbage, I think we can see perhaps a connection there.
Right. Huh. And that's even one that I hadn't thought of before with the snakes. And obviously, when you think about it, and I had Stephen Booner on recently, who has written a book called Sacred and Herbal Healing Beers, and he talks about, you know, the bees collecting the honey, and the honey, whatever plants the bees collected from would make the honey and or mead psychoactive or not, and as well as that was assumed that, you know, if the bees were eating the plants, that's where the poison from their stinger was coming from. So this is the same... This is the same theme repeating here, and that's a very fascinating subject, I think, in and of itself.
Well, toxic honeys are well attested. That's to say, bees feeding on certain plants give rise to honeys that can be toxic. And that's similar to, as I said, the milk of cows that are fed on certain herbage is toxic. There's something like milk jitters. That people who drink milk from cows that have eaten certain herbs develop. Mm.
Would you discuss the ancient practices surrounding trees and using them as intoxicants? You mentioned the juniper earlier. Which trees? How are they used? You know, what's the story behind that?
Well, I can't say I'm an expert really on trees. I mean, certainly the juniper is used, and I mean, I've not seen a reference to the calash and the use of juniper anywhere else at all, other than in writing specifically about the calash of the Hindu Kush. As I said, they use juniper directly as an intoxicant. That's to say, they burn it and they inhale its vapors. The kind of substances which are in juniper are these substances called terpenes, and the active principles in absinthe, the principles in wormwood, the intoxicating principles in wormwood, they're terpenes as well. And I believe that that salvia divinorum, that the substance in there, that again is a terpene type. That's a particular kind of chemical. But there's a lot of connections with trees in general. Obviously, we have the tree of life and in Genesis, and we're all well aware of that, and potentially what the significance of the tree of life is. I mean, Wasson, that was one thing that Wasson couldn't get away from in terms of Christianity, or at least Judaism and Christianity, which is simply that Genesis records that human self-awareness, which of course we would probably see as being a major step in the sense of development of human consciousness, was engendered by eating the fruit of a tree. But there's a huge number. I mean, there's a lot of references to different trees and plant materials being used, recorded by the ancients for the purposes of intoxication, not all of which have been successfully identified. But there's also the issue of resins and so on. That's to say, incenses that are derived from trees which are psychoactive or potentially psychoactive. One important tree resin incense is called oud, which is highly prized in the Middle East, and I don't think it's been tested, but is considered to be psychoactive, and is highly prized in Islamic cultures. But there's a book I refer to in my Hydron paper called Seth and the Search for the Oil of Life, and there's an awful lot of interesting stuff in there about trees. And of course, we have gods born from trees, and the author whose name escapes me at the moment of Seth and the Search for the Oil of Life refers to the centrality of the tree, and the tree as being or the herbage of the tree as being the agency of entering the underworld, if you like, which is, of course, we would equate with shamanic journeys. But it's a bit of a mystery. There's something there very important to be discovered. The tree, you have the Cymerg bird resides in the tree of life. You have there's certainly associations as well with Mary. That's to say that, Mary is the mother of Jesus, and trees, which somehow ties in with the birth of gods from trees. But I think that's about as far as I could take it, John.
Right. Did you see the image I sent you, I believe, about a week ago, the Simurgh from the Sassanid period, depicting the Simurgh with the woman, her assistant or whatever, feeding her an Amanita muscaria?
Yes, I've got to say on that particular point, Jan, that figure and the item that is held, I think it's that the woman is holding it to the beak of the Tiamurg. I mean, certainly traditionally or normally that is interpreted as a bunch of grapes. And the female figure there has well, what I'd always taken to be wine jars, if you like, hanging off her side. So I'm not convinced myself that necessarily represents the mushroom. Are there other reasons why you thought that was definitely a mushroom?
Well, I'm very familiar with the story typically representing grapes, and while, you know, it to me, looking at it, it just does not look like a batch of grapes. But I think, you know, again, I think that grapes are often a symbol that is used for intoxication in general. Often, whether or not if that's the true intoxicant that's being discussed. But I think the relation between the Simurgh and the phoenix is another thing that gives me pause to consider it as part of the mushroom. But another thing that I wanted to mention with regard to the tree symbolism in and of itself is the sap of the trees is high sugar content and can be fermented and used as an intoxicant that way. Another thing that I found interesting were the other various plants that look like lily or datura that were surrounding the outside of the platter that shows the Simurgh. So, you know, those are, you know, and I guess it's interpretive, but that one to me, it just doesn't look like a bunch of grapes to me. It looks like a mushroom that where the grapes are typically depicted. It's showing the spots on the cap of the mushroom.
Well, in one way or another, the Simurgh is certainly intimately associated with the Homer. But in all of my readings, I've really not been able to work out exactly why that is the case. In one sense, though, he's associated with Garuda, and he's the equivalent in a way of Garuda. So he's involved with bringing the Soma to man, the theft of Soma from the gods, and bringing the Soma to man, so the gift, if you like, of entheogens. So that's certainly one connection.
Let me ask you how you think the sacred bull or cow plays into the stories.
Well, I think that regarding the sacred bull or the sacred cow, I think that you'd have to really refer to Karl Ruck, Jan. I mean, there's a connection here. I mean, Brian Ackers, you said, wanted me to speak about the mushrooms in Spain. And plainly, potentially, there's a connection between bulls and psilocybin mushrooms, or psilocybin mushrooms that grow on the dung of mushrooms. But to digress for a moment to the petroglyphs in Spain, Karl Ruck and myself, Carl had these petroglyphs brought to his attention there in central Spain, not particularly distant from Madrid, close to quite a large town called Cuenca in Spain. And these petroglyphs are really pretty much unquestionably mushroom figures. You'd have to struggle hard to interpret them in some other way. And they are depicted in association with a bull, and certainly Carl's immediate reaction was to assume that they would be associated in terms of being set aside. But actually, I should say that's Gaston Guzman's association, that the connection is through the dung of the ball. But in other ways, as I understand it, Carl equates the mushroom and the ball directly, that the ball is the mushroom. And I think that this idea turns up in some of Watson's writings, doesn't it?
Yeah, yes, it does, in fact. And, you know, the different stories of the color of the skin and things like that. How do you think that these stories compare, you know, how do the correlations compare with Soma Haoma? Would you care to discuss that?
Well, there's certainly some things I'd like to say about Soma Haoma and those traditions. One is that the idea, for example, coming to Allegro specifically, or Allegro's idea that that Christianity was in some sense a mushroom cult, or even equating the figure of Jesus with the mushroom, that this is not necessarily a brand new idea. There's a book written in, I think, at the end of the 19th century by quite a significant French scholar. I believe he was the first person to translate the Bhagavad Gita into French. And I think he was also involved at the excavations of Troy. And he wrote a little book called, well, in French, but called in English, the Sacred Vase and That Which It Contains. And in that, he says that in Christ's passion, in his suffering, we're looking at a metaphorical account of the extraction of the soma and the homa. Now, I came across this book through a reference in Edward Arthur Waite's book, The Hidden Church of the Holy Grail. And so the idea that Christ could actually be the soma, or representative of an entheogen in its own right, it's not wholly new. And I was fascinated when I found, when I was aware of that, and when I was reading Franz Rosenthal's book, The Herb, which is this scholarly study of cannabis in Islamic traditions, or should we say Sufi, certainly in a Sufi Islamic context, and partly of its use in a Sufi context, that there was a Sufi account there, perhaps a poem or certainly a tradition, which refers to cannabis, the herb, the medicine, and it states there, yes, I'm quoting here actually, I'll just lift it up here. It says, yes, the transplanted son of cannabis, it is remarkable how in being killed, he kills us. And then goes on to talk about the preparation of cannabis in terms of toasting it and burning it and chewing it, and how by breaking it, so to speak, and by killing it, they enjoy the effects of the entheogen. They say it strangles us for having strangled it. And I was reminded, as a matter of fact, of that notion of the sacrifice, if you like, of the god as an entheogen when I was browsing a book by Mark Merlin, who's written quite a bit. He's an academic researcher into plant medicines and so on out of Hawaii. He was writing about kava, the Polynesian herb, and he referred in that context to this metaphor of the drug being a holy thing which is sacrificed in order to pass on its blessing, as it were, to the faithful. Mm-hmm.
I've got his book here.
That's Mark Merlin's book.
Yes, the Kava book.
Yes. Well, I think you'll find that reference in there. He's not referring specifically to Polynesian traditions, but simply to that idea. And it reminded me of this very important image, which, as I said, existed in Sufi tradition of the sacrifice, if you like, being a process by which You enjoy the use, the experience of the entheogen.
Recently, Chris Bennett found an amazing citation that he forwarded to both you and I. I'd like to read that and have you comment on it, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
The secret of secrets. Out of the scorching noon of Isaac, out of the dregs of wine, a fungus emerged, a cluster, male and female together, red as a rose, expanding in many directions and paths. From Zohar, the Book of Enlightenment.
Yes. I mean, certainly it's an intriguing quotation. Obviously, this is in translation, so it's hard to know exactly what the words used are in their specific context. So a fungus emerged, a cluster, male and female, together red as a rose, well, which is suggestive potentially of our manita, and there's also the association with wine. What kind of direction did it lead your own thoughts in then, Jan?
Well, in a way, I think, as I mentioned a minute ago with the Simurgh, you have this correlation between the wine and the fungus and these themes, the male and female together, the Aphrodite, or what's the other word I'm looking for right now? Anyway, but it seems to me that there's an overlap of these ideas, and whether or not in certain areas the fungus was used regularly, it seems to have been sort of a core originator of these themes, as we see in the myths and fairy tales.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. It's sort of the primary symbol that was used, even if something else was discussed. And I think that, while I say that, I also think that grapes are used in the same way, because anciently speaking, as far as I'm aware, almost none of the wine was just fermented grape juice like we think of wine today. As far as I'm aware, it was nearly always mixed wine and strong wine, just like the beers were. The gruit was always psychoactive. It wasn't just hops and barley. In fact, hops wasn't even a standard ingredient in beer until the 1600s. So, you know, they were using henbane and mandrake and belladonna and who knows how many other psychoactive plants. In fact, the word Pilsner is German for henbane and has nothing to do with the lager dirt-tasting Pilsner beers that we have today.
Well, let me throw another little spin on that, which is to say the adulteration of wines and beers. And obviously that's something that is monitored. And in connection with the paper that I worked on with Frederick Dalloway and Peter Webster, which was partially at least about ergot, I refer in there to a list of the ingredients that potentially would be used, and this was in the States in, I think, the 19th century, that potentially might be used to adulterate wine or beer, plainly to increase its intoxicating power. And that included a number of psychoactive plants, such as belladonna was included there, I think darnel grasses and so on. But let's put it this way, that taking a slightly different spin, that brewers through the ages must almost certainly have been aware of the psychoactive properties of plants. And we might call it now, or in the 19th century in the States, it might have been regarded as being adulteration. But we can, I think it's reasonable to assume that through the millennia that brewers have been aware and made use of the intoxicating properties of other plants in their brews.
I think it was central to ancient brewing. Have you read Stephen Booner's book?
No, I haven't. No. I'm aware of it though. That's the Sacred Beers. Mm.
Right. I'd highly recommend reading that. He's got some really good information in there regarding honey and mead and the gruit and things like that really tie in to what we're researching from these other angles. And I think that overall the fermentation aspect is highly overlooked. And I think in the last few years it's been gaining more attention, but traditionally fermentation has really been just blanketed over and forgotten about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.